This session of the 2013 Adelaide Festival of Ideas was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to... A funny thing happened on the way to the Vibrancy Forum here in the Adelaide Festival of Ideas. How are you feeling, Adelaide? Well, it's very vibrant. Good. That's fantastic. My name's Will McCrosty. You may know me from local vibrancy outlets, including Adelaide Roller Derby Free and Future, the Adelaide Festival Centre, Indaily, or the most vibrant of them all, ABC Local Radio. Welcome to the Adelaide Festival Ideas. We hope to take you on a circuitous and baffling journey through one of the more nebulous concepts ever to guide millions of dollars of public investment. This session is co-presented today with the Festival of Unpopular Culture and Arts SA. I'd like to acknowledge before we start that we're gathered on the traditional country of the Kaurna people of the Adelaide Plains and that we recognise and respect their cultural heritage, beliefs and relationships with the land. We acknowledge that they are of continuing importance to the Kaurna people today and we respect their elders past and present. And if we could turn Triple J off, we can begin. Hooray. A little bit of housekeeping at the start. Please switch your mobile phone to silent or turn it off. Oh my God, you might die. Who knows? Let's find out. You're welcome to connect with the festival. The tweet handle is at ADLFOI. The hashtag is #ADLFOI. You got it? And we've got hashtag FUCADL. I'm not going to say that phonetically. That's for the Festival of Unpopular Culture. We hope to see you tonight at the closing night seance at Nexus Cabaret as well. Prince Rama featuring shall be fun. Unauthorised recordings of any kind, not permitted. You will be turfed out. I will see to it personally. And today's session is being recorded by Radio Adelaide for broadcast and future podcasts. So if you don't like that, then bully for you. I just want to... We had a last-minute thing. I just wanted to nominate somebody to just maybe be a scribe for me.
Could you just get down like everything we talked about? It's going to be tabled in Parliament, so... Great.
Sorry?
Code, Trish.
I thought you were using...
Go the code.
Diagrams. All right.
Is that resolved, diagrams?
Seb, can you draw diagrams? Like, can you do graphic...
Yeah, great.
...representations of what we're saying with this whiteboard here.
Fantastic. Please feel free to respond to whatever the hell you want to respond to on your paper. There are some prompts there. Please ignore them. You'll also notice we have a microphone set up in the middle of the room. Welcome to those up the back. Hello, standing. This is going to be fun for you. Have a couple of drinks. There are drinks. Go get some.
There's a few more chairs just down here.
Don't tell them that. It's more fun to make them stand. Microphone in the middle of the room. We'll have some question and answer at the end. If you are not asking a question, I will cut your mic. There's also a feelings hat on the couch there that you must wear if you are asking a question. If you are not wearing the feelings hat, I will cut your mic. I'd like to introduce our panel, ladies and gentlemen. Gorgeous folks that they are. First off, to my right, we have Stan Marnie. Applause, please. Co-director of Festival of Unpopular Culture and Managing Director of Format Collective. Does anyone not know who Format is? Can I take that as read? No, people don't. Great. Format is a group of independent artists, musicians and writers based in Adelaide. Stan is thoroughly embedded in Adelaide's independent cultural scene and managing and promoting and writing about alternative culture for over a decade. It's a long time. Good job. I'm proud of you. Jennifer Greer Holmes. More applause. Works as a consultant across the arts and social justice sector. Creative producer of live art, mini video documentaries and special events. Very specific field. I like that. Good. And a passionate member of the independent arts community. Jennifer manages Zephyr
Quartet.
Oh, I'm back. I'm died. Hello. Is my cable not in? There we go. What else does she do? Currently working on a dance theatre work examining apology and shared guilt, tick, and a live art installation documentary investigating Hindley Street. Then we have Dr. Yanto Ware. Some would say this is all Yanto's fault. One of the founders of Format and Renew Adelaide, where he advocated for the review of red tape and governance systems inhibiting South Australia's cultural enterprises. And he bailed to Sydney recently to be co-director of the National Live Music Office under the Feds. Well done, Yanto. You've made it. To Yanto's right, we have Alex Reid, Group Executive Director, Arts and Cultural Affairs, including Arts SA, the Aboriginal Affairs and Reconciliation Division, and the Capital City Committee Directorate. Yes, I said it. In the Department of Premier and Cabinet. Prior to this, Alex was Director of Strategy, Policy and Initiatives at Arts SA, following 9 years with Country Arts SA. Did not know that. Cool. I'm learning. We're all learning. Yay for learning. Graduated from Flinders Drama Centre in 1990 and moved into arts administration some years later, taking up a post in Ceduna with Country Arts. Alex Reid, ladies and gentlemen. And furthest away from me, not by choice, Tim Horton, described as a serial pest and scourge by some of the best. As Adelaide's first Commissioner for Integrated Design, Tim provided independent expert advice to governments of Mike Rann and Jay Weatherill across design, planning and development in local, state and national policy, programs and projects. That is quite a list. Good job. Tim is an awarded architect with experience in Australia and internationally. Common throughout has been a deep interest in making innovation real in the architecture of space, policy and research. Tim's currently the CEO of the newly formed Committee for Adelaide. Committee for Adelaide. Tim Horton, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to start with the question that we've all been dying for an answer for some time. Yanto.
Yes.
Why do you hate vibrancy?
Before I answer that, do we have any Richard Florida fans here? Is anyone that's a big Richard Florida fan?
Nobody's heard of Richard Florida, Yanto.
Good, good. So there's this guy called Richard Florida who's kind of the scourge of the vibrancy movement. He's the one who kind of made it, him and Young Girl. And his influence on the vibrancy policy is very strong. He came to South Australia in 2005. You can still very clearly see his impact on our policy environment. And he had this kind of wacky idea that if you make your city fun and so it looks like Melbourne, it will become Melbourne. Except he came from the US. And he went around the whole world sort of spruiking these wacky theories to people. I didn't know that one, and I won't repeat that one. So he went around the world, made a lot of money spruiking this idea that you could make these kind of creative clusters that would attract this creative class. Cities all over the world followed that lead, paid a lot of money for it, particularly smaller and regional cities whose economies were collapsing in the face of the whole globalisation thing. And then last year he finally admitted he was wrong. Wrote a big article, and that legitimised a wave of people who'd been saying he was wrong for a long time and being ignored. And the three things that I guess I pick up from their work and the critique of him and the critique he eventually made of himself is firstly that it tends to, like, the whole vibrancy thing confuses effect with cause. So you give your city a Melbourne laneway or a Copenhagen bike lane or a Portland parklet, it doesn't develop the economic, demographic, structural features of that city that made it successful. The second thing that I think really kills the vibrancy thing is that by allowing individuals, agencies, policies, whatever, to just make the effect, it means they can kind of shield themselves from having to deal with the cause. So instead of dealing with economics or demographics, you just deal with the laneway and say, yep, city vibrated, we're fine now. And the following, I mean, that's kind of all kind of fairly harmless. Okay, you've got sort of nice public realm stuff now, it sounds really sweet. But the critique that Florida ended up making of his own work is that, and this is very, very particular and pressing for regional cities that are struggling to get a knowledge economy that need that kind of creative class, is that rather than having that kind of cluster approach of the vibrant laneways attracting a cluster class, a creative class, what it does is attract the existing wealth and capital in the city that all moves to the nice part of town. The property prices go up massively, creates a sort of false property bubble that zones out what's already there, it zones out anything innovative, so small-scale innovativity doesn't make a lot of money, and actually inhibits the capacity of that city to develop that knowledge class. Unfortunately, even though Florida himself has admitted his theories don't work, it's still very heavily across a lot of Australian policy environments. Cities are still vibrating left, right and centre, and even as you watch, like I work in quite a few regional cities, even as you watch their cities dying off, they're still busily vibrating. And that's why I hate vibrancy.
Fair enough. That that confusion between cause and effect is one that I find very interesting, and especially when it comes back to policy. I guess, Alex, you've had a lot of experience in developing policy across a variety of sectors where this can be
kind of a competing struggle where you have to move beyond looking at the effects and try and create the conditions where you want the effects to flourish. What mechanisms kind of exist in the policymaking environment to enable you to move beyond just looking at, ooh, parklets, and empowering people to do it themselves?
That's a really good question. I think, you know, there's a fairly standard answer that would go something like, you know, we build in evaluation frameworks and we measure certain things, we establish indicators at the outset and we watch those indicators diligently and see whether those indicators move one way or another, and if they do, we change what we do, and if they don't, we keep doing what we're doing against, you know, blah, blah, blah. There's that kind of a standard answer, and certainly many of the policies in this kind of area are accompanied by that kind of monitoring and evaluation and watching and changing. But I think for me, the thing that's interesting in what Yanto's saying and the discussion generally, I'm a really firm believer in taking a very long-term view on things, and as policymakers and as officers and as, you know, whatever it is that we're all doing, if you take a 5, 10, 15, 20, 30-year view over these things, as we really should be, then we use all kinds of language at all kinds of times and in all kinds of ways to describe what it is we're trying to do. But if you go back over, say, a 30-year period, in this place at least, there's been a pretty consistent and bipartisan, if we're talking the politics of it, effort to create an environment where stuff happens. To me, the whole vibrancy thing is, whether it's called that or buzz or whatever activation, it's just about stuff happening and being able to happen in a way that isn't inhibited by a range of structures and forces around it. And if you go back that kind of length of time, there are people in this room, because I'm seeing some of you, who have been in this kind of game for at least that long, for decades and decades and decades. And whether it's called vibrancy or anything else, this is an effort that's ongoing, and it's an effort that's been ongoing over that time and will continue to have traction over time. The Floridas of the world come and go, and those ways of describing it come and go, but the fundamental proposition, that is, do we want to be in a place where stuff happens that engages us in all kinds of ways? That stuff could be sport, that stuff could be go-kart racing, that stuff could be art, as it is that we're talking about today, but it's stuff at the end of it and it's happening and we're participants in it and want to be.
Tim, did you have something to add?
Floridas come and go, but bureaucracies live on and on. Is perhaps the unfair retort to that. I think what we've got here is your classic case of dark matter. We are talking about some missteps that were taken in the 30s in Adelaide, and here we're talking specifically about Adelaide, but generally Australian cities reflect this. Massive urban expansion that threw a population out to the out from the centre means that people now increasingly live further from each other, and it's harder for people to do what Alex is talking about, which is sort of, you know, to get stuff happening. The question is not whether the stuff happens or not. The question is how organic that stuff can happen versus how much pump priming. I think the big question for Adelaide and Australian cities is how fast we move from a fairly naive, early, fully pumped, primed, massive public sector investment into something which is organic and free-flowing. That entrepreneurship that I just heard Charles Landry talk about and the creativity. I have to throw up some challenges here, which is the last time we measured the creative industries in this town was 2005. Last time I looked, it's 2013. Excellent to hear it's just been done again. Alex can talk a bit more about that. Integrated Design Commission tried to do some in 2010, and for me, the one thing I'm going to come back to is going to sound extremely boring, but you don't know what you don't know, and you don't know what you don't know if you don't take steps to know it. Data is everything. What is the experience of young entrepreneurs and young creative types to get access to finance? What is the experience within their own little value chain? Who do they sell to? Who don't they sell to? Why don't they sell to them? This is the next thing we need to get down to understand, to give them the dignity of A, being visible to government, B, to understand how we can truly help them. And that's more likely, I think, to get the organic going And the challenge for that is it will be cross-agency.
I want to move kind of to the creative arts sector specifically. Jen, a lot of artists and a lot of people in the arts sector, and I know that there are some blurry lines between arts and creative industries and creative entrepreneurs and all of that, but a lot of people in what we would call the arts sector reacted pretty viscerally and pretty negatively to a lot of vibrancy programs that have occurred in the last couple of years. Was it a foregone conclusion that that community would react in that way? Or do you, like, why do you think that reaction has been so kind of, you know, intense?
I don't think it was a foregone conclusion that that sector would react in that way. I think, speaking from my personal experience and the experience of many of my peers in the sector, and particularly from the independent arts sector, the smaller companies and artists who aren't necessarily connected to a major company, we started being invited to consultation meetings and processes, which to begin with felt as though our knowledge was being valued and respected, and still 5, 6, 7 years later, we're being asked the same questions by different people who should be talking to each other. And to pick up on the point that Tim just made, data gathering is really vital, but it's that they're not gathering data, it doesn't feel like. The questions that we're being asked are very much more about what ideas we've got, and then we tell them the same ideas that we've been having for probably decades, and they say, that's a really good idea. And then we get asked the same question by the next government department at another forum. And I guess the other thing that I can lead to from there is that some of the consultation processes are kind of wrapped up in other labels, like young leadership development, professional development opportunities, but then they're actually a consultation process. There was another one that I personally wasn't involved in, but I spoke to lots of people that went to one about the nighttime economy, particularly around arts activity and nightclubs and liquor sales, which is fantastic. We need to collect information about that, but it started at 8:30 in the morning. So those people whose knowledge is apparently so highly valued and should be respected, there is a complete lack of understanding from the people who are inviting them into these processes to be able to engage fully. So there's some people that are being completely locked out of the process who should be there. And I guess, you know, that's where some of that cynicism and negativity comes from, is that the repetition and not always feeling respected by the process.
Stan, what's your experience of small community groups becoming marginalised and disenfranchised and sad? Sadder.
I think sadness lends itself to vibrancy. Manchester was very sad during a very vibrant period in its history. I tire of telling the story, so bear with me if I seem droll. I'm managing director of a collective of artists founded by Dr. Yanto Ware that kind of pride themselves on being experimental, underground, various other kind of excuses for using nothing but cardboard and milk crates to throw parties, ostensibly in the interest of DIY art and culture, but often winding up dancing to Beyoncé very late at night.
Stick
around very late tonight, by the way. Yanto kind of roped me into it some years ago because he was getting old and didn't, you know, was no good at getting hipsters to show up to the shows and buying drinks, which we needed to pay the rent. Because, you know, there's only so many grants you can apply for before you start hating yourself. And it was wildly successful. So successful that a very large community built up around it. One that had already started when it was just an annual festival, but it quickly grew and it quickly became kind of a cornerstone of a fairly diverse community of DIY practitioners, musicians, zinesters, independent publishers, a whole strange gamut of people across a number of disciplines. And then a developer moved in and is in the process of turning our former gallery and live music and recording studio into a vibrant small bar. Now, ironically, Yanto and Format Collective were, along with Renew, were spearheading the small venues license. And small venues are amazing. They do make a city. But it seems like it's another question of that. It's another problem of community consultation of those measurables that Tim is referring to. There are immeasurable, you wouldn't call them indicators because you can't really see them, but a poetic, an overly poetic way to put it at the end of this festival that I've been running on No Sleep is when you step off a plane in a new city, sometimes you sniff the air and you can tell that there are dodgy basements covered in terrible graffiti where people are doing strange experimental things. And those things aren't necessarily measurable. They don't, you know, they're not very good at demonstrating their KPIs to government departments and funding bodies, but they really make a city, you know. And even if you don't go to those places, you can almost literally smell them in a city, you know? and the problem that we're grappling with and that we're trying to articulate is how do you get governments who are staffed by very hardworking, well-meaning people to measure or at least create the conditions where those places can operate safely in a rapidly gentrifying, limited CBD. And so we're kind of, as a collective, now forced into that strange sort of lobbyist, activist role when we'd really rather be dancing to Beyonce until 4 a.m.
So vibrancy smells. Everybody write that down. That's takeaway number one for today. Right on your papers. There we go. Booze pays the rent.
Sure does.
So let's just confirm that for small weird art ventures, booze pays the rent.
That's another question. I hate to bring class into it, but I really do. Like, because I have a beard and I am surrounded by, you know, communists.
Right now or in your life generally?
Just in my life generally. Insufferable, you know. One of the things I can't stand hippies. It's just unfortunate that their politics align so perfectly with mine. But there really is an attitude, particularly in this town, that people can't be trusted. Young people can't be trusted to adhere to the building code. Bogans can't be trusted to have glasses after 3 a.m. You can't be trusted to leave a venue and go to another venue after 3 a.m. now. I was going to approach this event, I was going to be facetiously pro-government and say, well, maybe they can't be trusted. Maybe this town is full of, you know, awful people and it's beyond hope. I see... oh, he's gone. Never mind. Oh, hi. What's his name again?
Seth.
Yeah, I see Dr. Seth Williams.
Nichols.
It's been a long festival. We put on an event a few days ago, which was, has the environment got to a stage where it's impossible to regenerate? Are we now in a situation where we have to mitigate the effects rather than try and prevent? Trying to save or regenerate biodiversity, climate change, things like that. Or do we stick to this sort of high-minded idea of changing the culture? But maybe the culture will change, or that, you know, the policy development will change so slowly that by the time we get there, we're covered in concrete and desert anyway, and there's no point. So maybe the rationale in for example, the Department of Planning, DIPTI, is that law enforcement now has to step in. Now, we've created a culture of binge drinking and booze bars. Law enforcement now has to step in and take away people's glasses. You know, are we really at that stage in this town? And I'm not saying we are, and I'm not saying we aren't, but a decision apparently has been made that certain groups of people don't deserve to be trusted anymore. And that's something that we need to think about very deeply. Write that down.
Jen, can we trust young people?
I don't know if we can trust young people, but I don't fit into that category anymore, and I'm also untrustworthy, apparently, because my drink got taken away from me the other night and tipped into a shoddy plastic glass that I'd just paid through the nose for, and I don't like to drink out an expensive drink out of a plastic cup. And there was no need for it. Like, no one was doing anything. We weren't going to glass each other.
How do you know? How do they know you're not going to glass each other?
Well, I don't know that they can know that, but the other night when we were kind of brainstorming about this forum and some of the issues that we might raise, we discussed a whole variety of ways that we might be able to hurt each other without glassware, of other items that are in any venue where you might purchase liquor. And indeed, some of the, you know, high density, unsmashable plastic reinforced cups are still pretty heavy, and you know, they might not smash, but you could probably do a fair bit of damage with them. And so it just doesn't make any sense. It's offensive. I find it very offensive that somebody can't be trusted after midnight. Like, it's at this weird time, like at 11:59, I'm completely trustworthy, and yes, give me my drink in a glass. At 12:01, everything turns, and I'm not allowed to drink out of a glass anymore. It's baffling.
It is baffling. The only explanation is it's a kind of a dog whistle aimed at tabloids and talkback radio outrage.
Exactly.
Alex?
couldn't possibly comment. No, that's right. But I think it's all of those things. It's all of those things embroiled in decisions that are made for any number of reasons, some of which will appear apparent and obvious to us, and some of which will remain a complete mystery forever, why that decision was made or why that was important. I think I'm sitting here thinking, you know, it's interesting, it's a real conundrum, and I haven't worked my way in any sense through this conundrum, but I've said to some of these guys in the last year or so, you know, I've spent 20 years of my professional life trying to get all kinds of parts of government to just glance in our direction, you know, on the basis that if you just glance in our direction, great riches will fall from the sky and land in your lap for very little effort on your part. I doubt there's any of you in the room who wouldn't agree in broad terms with that proposition. And for many of us, that's been our life's work. And yet, as soon as the said other areas of government, in my case, and it could be the private sector in other people's examples and experiences, as soon as they did start not just to glance in our direction, but actually start knocking on our door and in some instances offering to contribute to certain activities and initiatives and various things, we found ourselves in this conundrum. Oh my God, they're talking to us now and they're actually wanting to do something with us, and they're using our language. We don't trust that they understand that, though. They don't understand who we are and what we do. They don't understand us. They don't know really deeply at their core who we are, because they're not part of us. And so I find myself in this kind of odd place where I've spent that long trying to argue our case and advocate for that kind of participation and engagement and shared resourcing in some instances. And now that it's happening, in some instances, because it's not happening on our terms, in some instances, I'm not referring to those that have been just discussed, it's almost go back outside that door, because it's a real conundrum, and I don't know how we get to that, because we are talking off it, we are using different language, and we're we have different concepts and different experiences. But one of the things I say a lot is, you know, none of us have a mortgage on passion. None of us. And I work, you know, with all kinds. In the Aboriginal Affairs area is a particularly good example. When you spend a lot of time in that space, I have a different perspective on this space and this conversation and these kind of discussions, and a different, you know, there are different motivations and drivers going on there. So it is a conundrum. How do you reap those benefits and share in those resources where they are resources, or just be part of the same discussion when you're in many instances on a whole nother planet? Mm. And not always, on both sides of the equation, not particularly willing to share space over any meaningful period of time, which I think is the only way you really do it. I often think, and I haven't found a way to do this, I often think, you know, sometimes I think I want to hang out. It's kind of the trade, you know, trading places thing. Do we need to do a bit more of that kind of trading places thing and actually spend some time in each other's spaces and in each other's worlds?
Yes.
To try to understand that. I often think maybe you guys should hang out with me for a couple of weeks.
Do you know what the most efficient community consultation would be is if you came to a show? Not you, Alex.
No.
I've seen you at the odd show.
Yeah,
or at least you attend on Facebook.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, I do.
So do all of you, let's be honest.
But my God, like a young leadership forum at 8:30 in the morning is not attracting anybody who's making this town more interesting.
Or at least in a state where they can contribute.
Except we were there.
I've only started going to these things because we were, like, viciously marginalised out of a rapidly gentrifying laneway. Mm. When we made that laneway fucking vibrant, man. We vibrated the living daylights out of that laneway, and then a property developer nailed us, and we were just left to swing in the breeze. Now, I'm not saying we should expect them to understand us immediately, but if it's your job to be across the creative industry, go to some shows. And go to some shows that are not run by yuppies. Go to some weird shows, like right down...
Weird, smelly shows.
In the stinky basement shows. Or, like, talk to your freaky cousin with the weird haircut that goes to those shows. You don't have to go to them yourself, but at least sort of understand them and understand how important they are. Because the more visible you are, sometimes the less important you are. You know, the louder you are and the more you spout about social innovation or career development or other naff beige stuff like that, the less important you are to the life of a city and to the creative landscape generally.
And the more you argue against that when you do reject those kinds of terms, the more you are shut out of any process that
might
benefit you.
Are you getting on a Fleming now? Do I have to stop you?
I need the feelings hat. The more you go to the 8:30 in the morning forums and talk about these amorphous concepts of vibrancy and stuff, no, you need to take the hat off.
Well, then you're not allowed to have feelings.
The less you have time for your own practice. I mean, that's something that people whinge about a lot, but it bears repeating. The more grants that you have to fill out, the more you have to engage with government. There's such a thing as government engagement as well, which is an amusing thing that we did in the first Festival in Popular Culture. The less time you have for your own creative work and the less time that you have talking to other artists, collaborating, doing you know, real experimental things that keep a town ticking over. So there has to be a balance, obviously, but it's wildly askew right now in terms of consultation, in terms of government engagement.
So many of those sounded like end of sentences. Good. Tim!
So I believe that something's happened over the last 2 years that we haven't made explicit. And I've been complicit in this, so here's my public apology. I believe that we've given government a new... a dialect and a new vocabulary that hasn't come necessarily with a new understanding. So what we're getting, I think, is in fact the spectacular success of tactical urbanism. Does anybody know term, tactical urbanism. Josie, you're not putting up your hand. You know. I know you know. Charles knows. Tactical urbanism is effectively the idea that while we're waiting for worlds to shift and for regulations to change and for building codes to be rewritten, there's stuff we can all do. There's stuff we can do sometimes by seeking forgiveness rather than asking permission. That may be closing our street for an impromptu laneway party at 5 o'clock. It may be setting up a coffee cart in our front yard without a licence. I don't know. Things like that. That's tactical urbanism, things that you can do to change your surroundings without necessarily seeking approval. So tactical urbanism actually has become the favoured domain of government because let's think about it. It's quick, it's fast, it's cheap, it works within our election cycles. We can take photos of it. People seem to love it. So in place of structural reform...
Except for middle management in local councils who are confused and frightened by it.
So this is the challenge. I believe technical urbanism is coming up against its... A, has been appropriated by governments, which I see as parties in place of good planning, which is a problem. We are leaving no long-term legacy here. So I believe you can read this in the with the, those from Adelaide City Council. I apologise in advance. You can read this empirically.
Just pissed off half the
audience, we have put out an ad for 4 placemakers, and yet it's taken a year for a chief planner not to be appointed. So we're going for the quick and the dirty, the cheap, the painted sulo bin, the cluttered furniture in Bank Street, as opposed to the structural reform, the stuff we know we need to do, which is harder, longer, takes partnership. But don't worry, it's okay. We've got the vocabulary in place and we're now hip to the lingo. So my problem is governments have learnt from activists and activists are now the ones looking for those grown-up conversations.
But hasn't that always been the case? I think if we think about other areas of government... environmental movement, perhaps, might be one half reasonable example.
We've given an acceptable term now.
Yeah, that's right.
It's okay. Right. It's sort of its splash and its activation and its pop-up. Whereas before it was really just short-termism and it was the stuff you expected of a council.
Yeah, and perhaps, I guess, what do you do with that? What do you make of that? The reasons why something happens on a given day or somebody says or does something are so many. The reasons are so many. Sometimes the minutiae would just blow your mind. So what do you do with all of that? To me, that's kind of the world I operate in to some extent. And so I'm perhaps more immune to that because of the time that I've spent in that world. But what do you do with that? Do you just make the art? As Stan is saying, is the best response just to make the art, just to close your ears to that stuff and get on with making art wherever you can, in whatever way you can, hampered as you are, or flourishing as you might be. Is that one response?
Is that a question for me? Because it sounds like it sounds like what you're doing. So how do you respond to that? You provide good analysis and data to prove that, in fact, it's not just the art as a craft or practice that's important, but it plays into an innovation agenda, it plays into a planning agenda, it plays into a transport city activation strategy, it plays into residential growth, it plays into all these things, and here are the figures that show it. This is not a single slap on the desk, once only report. This is a movement we need to get into where we're into feedback loops on what we learn and what we know and what we trial. While ever we're spending $1.5 million or whatever it was in Bank Street, we're not spending that on permanent reforms in Hindley Street, for example, or growing Hindley Street so we're diluting the dickheads, as some good work with police and traders and Yunto and others through the integrated design strategy sort of showed. So we make choices about where we spend money. We need to make sure that we're making those decisions for a long term so that there's an enabling framework that allows the organic to grow. And at the moment, we're just, I think, don't yet have the balance right, which is why I look forward to phase 2 of the vibrancy agenda. I needed to finish on an up note.
can I jump in on money? Because money seems to be the very unequal kind of aspect here at an individual level, talking about artists spending more time understanding government and engaging. The difference to me is that people in government are getting paid. Artists are not.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. As Yanto has recently learned.
Having just made the transition to getting paid for a living. Yeah.
Yeah.
It makes a big difference.
so, you know, it's all well and good to go out and say, you know, that the creative sector needs to understand the government sector more, et cetera, et cetera. Jen, do you want to speak to that kind of inequity?
Just very briefly, I mean, I can speak on personal experience where, you know, the amount of hours that I've spent in consultation processes now as a freelance consultant has probably cost me around $3,000 or $4,000 in wages. And on many of those occasions, I've denied work that I have to attend because I thought that it was important that I be there and make a contribution from a worker in that sector that represents, you know, many of those voices. It's now gotten to a point where I cannot justify contributing that voice when I will lose money. And so that's my perspective on that. It costs me money to attend those things. So
we need an army of gens, and we need them to be in a comfortable position to do the advocacy and the development that they do. I mean, in answer to your quandary, Alex, there are organisations in the community that are nimble and that are embedded in the community. So that expensive, often ham-fisted community consultation process can be replaced by outsourcing it to the private sector.
Yep.
To existing collectives of artists,
for example.
Hi. Or there's a lot of them are represented here. People, there's the Majoran Distillery, for example, on Grenfell Street, or you know, wonderful groups of artist studios who are run by people who have that extraordinary ability to, you know, stay abreast of what's at the forefront of the creative sector, but also are able to fill out the odd form and apply and put in the odd application. Those organisations are so valuable, so valuable, and they make, I think, government's job much easier because they're already there, you know.
And that technique has sort of been sporadically employed, like Renew started through devolved funding through TAXI, and then it developed quite good policy relationships, and we did provide feedback back into the system, and we worked with you guys in doing that very well, in my opinion. There were still big structural problems in certain parts of governance, and like I think goes with the Florida critique, because those sectors that didn't want to change or didn't have the capacity to change could shield themselves by doing the effect and not addressing the cause, that impetus for change both within government and those outside of it tended to just disappear or get stuck, and then people would get frustrated and then they would start bickering with each other. And, yeah, it was kind of like a structural governance block rather than a fundamental fault in structure. The structure was good, the strategy was good, the tactics went awry.
Does it also, Will, I'm also thinking, you know, on the question of the input that you make as practicing artists and small to medium organisations and the cost to you, it's interesting, you know, that the overall arts budget in this state, let's say in round figures, is about $130 million, okay? Has been that for a number of years. There's been a fairly significant shaving of that over the period that we all know, and just as other departments have as well, but there's been other money that's come into that space. So in round figures, it's kind of landed about that. And, a large proportion of that support is going to the major organisations. That goes without saying, the vast majority of that. It costs a lot to keep those very large institutions, their doors open. I have wondered at times, you know, in my world, I move between something like this and then you know, meetings with their boards. And I do wonder about our capacity to share internally as well some of this effort, both the understanding of the question, but also their capacity. They're like me, and now we aren't. They're paid. You know, they're running large organisations, and they're paid to run them as well as they do. What capacity do they have to share in some of this story and some of this narrative, and to be advocating? Because I find myself having similar but different discussions with them. It's, you know, the art form might be different, the medium might be different, But so much of the underlying question is the same. And yet there's, you know, there's a breakdown in, or a lack of communication even within that 130 million, within the arts portfolio itself. How much meaningful communication happens between those large funded organisations and you guys?
Well, can I
step virtually
on?
None.
And
that's, you know, not despite us trying to get
I know.
Can I stick on that with two yeah. parts? How do you think a competitive funding system plays into that? And how do you think a fear of biting the hand that feeds you plays into that?
Can I put a proviso on that?
Sure.
Before we solely ask the question around arts funding, I'm just here mystified as to why it's an arts funding question. So I think we should give Alex some freedom that it should not be only the 130. Can I give you three stats that prove that this is not an arts question? Last year, 2,909 more people left the state than came. Since 1990, 32,000 more people have left the state than came, and 49% of those are between the age of 20 and 39. So there is this fundamental question about this state's viability around a certain cohort. This is not about throwing up the borders to stop people escaping. It is about making sure that those who occupy certain demographic and practice niche within the economy have a way to sustain themselves, because let's be base about it, this is the two-thirds of jobs in this state come from micro-enterprise.
Can I provide a very personal part of that statistic? A couple of years ago, on Christmas Eve, no less, just to do something very depressing, I compiled a list of 152 people that I knew since the age of 16 who have left this state, who now all work in creative, innovative jobs elsewhere. Since 2 years ago, I know another 50. So 202 people.
And how many do you know who have arrived?
Those people.
I know
who don't just
about
run large institutions.
Yeah, four people that have come here, yeah. And most of that is to raise a family and to not work in the creative sector anymore. So everything that you've just said rings very true to me, and to lose people like Yanto, and for the first time in my life, at the age of 36, to be considering bailing.
Oh, I'm off. I'm off after this.
it's really confronting.
Another thing that occurs to me, there's a lot of talk about critical mass. It's like, oh, but we can't do that in Adelaide. We're just Adelaide. We don't have the critical mass. I mean, Adelaide is mass migrating to Melbourne and Sydney to provide their critical mass. That half the people on that list who went to Melbourne and Sydney aren't starting new and wonderful things in Melbourne and Sydney. No, they're piss-poor artists in Melbourne and Sydney. They just went there because it's more fun over there. Well, like, it's kind of a bald-faced point, but, like, those laneways that we all are trying to replicate are populated by starving artists, you know? They're run by yuppies, but they're patronised by people doing weird, experimental, not very lucrative art practices, and they were doing them in Adelaide, they were doing them quite cheaply in Adelaide, and they were probably getting reasonably decent support, but they were just bored to their tits, so they moved to Melbourne. Well, you know,
Alex, can I reframe?
It's not small bars that's going to keep them here.
What I was going to ask you then and ask is, are there any strategies that you know of, either at a departmental or a whole of government level, to understand these demographics, their challenges, both at a, you know, broad kind of cohort level and an individual level?
I'm guessing there are.
I think there are strategies, and
you know, different departments will be doing it in different ways. If the heart of the question is, does anybody care about that in government, then the answer is yes, because... And I genuinely believe they care. It's an interesting standpoint. It's an interesting one because if they left because they're bored, not because they weren't supported, that's quite different to what I normally hear. I normally hear they left because they weren't supported and they couldn't make art. If what you're saying is, or in part what you're saying is, they left for a whole variety of reasons, one of which is they were bored, and then they went to Melbourne or Sydney, and they're not bored, but they're still starving and struggling to support their art, then
But they're making those cities tourist attractions.
This is but as artists, they're in the same, if not worse, position financially, or at least
And that's not what I was suggesting. I was suggesting that there's better opportunities for money.
You're suggesting
elsewhere.
Two different things, but that to me talks to a problem that is an Australian problem rather than an Adelaide specific problem or a South Australian problem.
It's a regional Australian problem.
It's a regional Australian problem.
And it's a problem we see in Wollongong, it's a problem we see in Townsville, it's a problem we see everywhere. And I guess that's the kind of young creative who left, like I used to write and play in bands and end up working in policy. When we started Format, we started that, Joel Catchlove and I started that, because we were sick of being pushed into the youth arts bracket and told, oh, there's some nice youth artists. And then, so we decided to start this thing. And then as part of that, because I was working at a research institute and I kind of recognised the whole, you know, white male privilege thing, sitting around whinging didn't really seem like a moral answer. That it might be a good idea to try and do government engagement and see if there were people in government who wanted to work with us. And there were. There was ample people. But there were structural faults that when we set up Format, you know, my life, if I hadn't had to learn about the building code, I could still be running Format. That would have probably been more fun than learning about the building code. Is that there were structural faults in there that did make it insurmountable and meant that even if we were happy to be poor, we simply couldn't do it. I think the tragedy I found with South Australia is that we worked really well with certain departments and certain sections. And then there was these just bits that didn't move and didn't really want to move, and they would vibrate, and that was it. All that effort, both within government and outside, it would disappear. And that, and we can sort of frame this being an arts issue, but you know, Tim's right. Like, if you look at the demographic profile and the economics of South Australia, after the dollar floated, this state just started collapsing. It's now at a point where the youth exodus is so extreme that within the next sort of 20 years, you're not going to be able to pay for your ageing population, which is particularly relevant for those of you who are younger, getting involved with this and deciding whether you want to leave or stay or, you know, get into politics or fight about policy, because it's like you're going to end up footing the bill for the healthcare of your parents if you want them to be taken care of properly. You need to have a knowledge economy. You need to have innovation. At the moment, watching that kind of idea of innovation disappear into, like, one of the problems we had particularly, I mean, my problems are predominantly with the council. I think having 6,000 people vote in the capital city council is ridiculous. Is that innovation doesn't look like what Melbourne did 5 years ago. Innovation looks like weird lunatics wearing stupid hats, and it looks like the dodgy basements, and it's hard to pick up indicators and work with it. But there are, you know, sort of low-risk, easy strategies to do it. They have been done here. I think it's a shame that we saw Thinkers in Residence and the IDC shut down, because I thought they were a really good mechanism for doing that. There is still a legacy there. There is still reason to be positive, but there's structural faults that prevent you sort of making the most of the agency of the people who live here to get that kind of creative enterprise going.
Moving to that question of demographics more, and Tim, you addressed this at the very start, talking about you know, flight to the suburbs and the decentralisation of a population. Give us a picture of what the kind of, you know, this is SimCity, what are the ideal demographics for, you know, a vibrant city in your mind? Density,
mixed.
Ages, mixed. Education?
Mixed is the answer. And we saw some, anyone who was at Charles's talk before this saw the actual, you know, saw the buildings set on the square that were a mixture of, if you like, what we'd call the high-end market housing and social housing in one. So what you get there is those who stay during the day and so activate places while people head off to where they may work, which in a traditional Australian sense is sort of back in the CBD. Increasingly that's changing. But what we get in Australia is the fastest growing demographic is the over 65s, and the fastest growing subset of that is single women over 65. Now you can choose to see that as a problem, or you can choose to see that as part of the mix that you want in your public realm. The secret here is that it's not all about young people doing sort of crazy things. You know, the reality is that for that innovation equation to work, you need, if you like, entrepreneur, idea and capital together. So you need a constant marketplace here for those who are making, those who are consuming, those who are doing what a lecturer of mine used to just call dithering. So public space needs to allow a lot of that dithering to happen. Makes sense when a lot of that is multi-generational. My 9-year-old son was taught to walk in Taylor Square off Oxford Street. That is not, you know, in designing policy around Taylor Square in Oxford Street, for those of you who know it, you would not have designed it as a place to teach a four-year-old to walk, but, you know, we happen to live there at the time. So the point is that just like we've been talking about this need for organic growth, cities also need a little bit of sort of organic as well. So it's about designing for that organic.
How do you do that? I mean, a lot of these theories that you... I mean, the same could be said of the lecture today. A lot of the theories that I hear about, we need cities that look like this. What's a healthy city look like? Oh, it looks like, you know, Barcelona or Portland. Those are cities in another part of the world. They have completely different relationship to economics. We live in a post-colonial country. We live in a country that even Adelaide wasn't designed to be vibrant. It wasn't designed to be a knowledge economy. It was designed to send wheat and wool back to the British Empire. It did that very, very well under Playford.
1834, can I tell you a story? Two people just collapsed with exhaustion. 1834 in the UK... they came up with this crazy title that really could have been generated out of a bureaucracy today. South Australia was to be the model of what they call the... let me just get this correct. Vicinity maximising, dispersal minimising principle. It was a density model. The fear was that when we landed, we'd spew off over the landscape and we'd fail to get the agglomeration of wealth and employment and labour and all those things. So we needed to bring people together. Cue the square mile city. Secondly...
and the Strangways Act.
And before we... and my punchline was actually not going to be that. My punchline was going to be that the social places that brought people together of the day, in fact, not the drinking houses, but in fact were churches. And so what you then got was the density of churches within the square mile. My argument for the Adelaide-based model is that we need to effectively draw a ring not around the whole of the urban footprint. In fact, it is the Crossroads, South Road, Regency Road type of ring, and then we need to do a lot inside that. That is, and then once we've done that, we've got a really big question, which is what do you do outside that? And for me, no city in Australia has fronted up to what we need, which is what's the model of contraction? How do you make retreating into a thriving core work? And the core is not the square mile. The core is that much larger. Mm.
But the original ideology behind the design of the city under, was it Wakefield, was that you would have... like, it wasn't designed to be democratic originally. It was like, we're going to have a... landed population that can afford to drive industry and can afford to buy land. We're going to have the Strangways Act, so we don't end up with the squatters that have caused problems in the state. And then we're going to make it equitable so we can get high-skilled workers to man the manufacturing hub to ship shit out to London. And Australia did that really, really well up into the whole globalisation of the economy thing, and that's the big problem we've had. It's not about vibrant laneways. It's about the economy has shifted radically after the, Bretton Woods Agreement? After that got trashed in the 70s, dollar floats in, was it 84? Those are the big issues. It's more important to understand them and their cultural impact and think about concepts of democracy and participatory culture than to think about vibrancy.
So I don't disagree on any of that, except for one slight nuance, which is it's very true that the original business model for South Australia was to sell land in order to fund human capital growth. I think we did one. I just think we forgot to do the other.
That idea of retreating into a centralised city that is you know necessarily of higher density, how do you then overcome? And this is for Tim again. We're on a thing now, apparently. How do you then overcome the attitudes of existing residents, or you know, how do you work with existing residents? Because you know, NIMBYism, not in my backyardism, is something that hampers activity both in the traditional vibrancy.
Can I answer that one rather than Tim?
Sure.
Well, first off, the biggest thing, I think, having the more councils, the more state governments I work with interstate, the biggest threat facing South Australia is that it's a city and a state that's really reliant on its capital city. You don't have secondary cities, you don't have a Geelong, you don't have a sort of Gold Coast, yet your capital city has 6,000 people, all of more or less the same demographic voting for it, and I just don't think that's enough to produce the necessary public discourse, the diversity of perspectives, or the quality of the local government members to produce good strategy.
How do we fix that, Yanto?
You massively broaden the voter base, and I would look at making the city's voter base the people who actually use it, not just the people who can afford to live here.
Do you want to speak to that?
Charles Landry had a very good report in 2003, which looked at questions of governance based on the sort of city you want. And it came down to, I don't mean to verbal the man who's in the front row in actual fact, but it did come down to a very interesting model that has, that maybe in fact the Festival of Unpopular Culture has put on the agenda for Adelaide, a question around what do we want? What should our government look like in order to get the city that we want? And there is a very patient, calm, rational, informed discussion to be had about some of that.
I don't know, a year ago maybe, some of you perhaps were at a theatre forum at AC Arts, and we were talking about funding. Or the conversation went all over the place, but one of the things we were talking about was funding for the small to medium sector in the theatre arena. And as Will said, I come from a theatre background, from an actor, trained as an actor, and you know, for my money, I'm not sure there's a more collaborative art form than theatre, but that's my take on that. But we were talking about, people were having a go about it, you know. Somebody said, you know, years ago, and they were remembering kind of the good old days, years ago, if you'd had the job years ago, Alex, you would have been in there and you would have been arguing for, you know, and you would have been doing this and you would have been doing that and arguing for the money, and you would have been in the trenches, the political trenches around all of this. And I said, actually not, that you're remembering, your memory is failing you.
You're wrong.
That is not true, yes. You're wrong. As an officer, as a bureaucrat, I wouldn't have been, even 20 years ago. My counterparts 20 years ago were not doing that, because that's not what the system doesn't do that, and the system hasn't changed in that 20 years. The very big difference, I said, 20 years ago, you would have been a member of a political party, whoever you were sitting around in this theatre forum. You would have been a member of a political party, and I'm not going to say which one you would have been a member of. It's most likely you would have been a member of one rather than the other, but that as it may, you would have been a member of a political party, and what you would have been doing right about now, and this was a year ago, right about now, you would have been sitting around on someone's lounge room floor with a few bottles of red wine, and you would have been writing the arts platform for that particular political party. And in another lounge room somewhere, somebody else would have been writing the platform for, and you know, and then a few months later, that would have turned into a policy, and then people like me would have just been handed it, and somebody would have won, and we would have gone to election, and someone would have won, and someone would have lost, and whoever won, that was the policy for the period of time, for the 3 or the 4 years, or whatever it might have been. But it was an observation, and the people who'd been arguing, in fact, those that were old enough to remember that, all agreed. And they said, you're right, that is what we used to be doing. And we've, somewhere in that period of time, we've moved away from that kind of participation as well, political participation. Not moved away from activism, I don't think, but we've moved away from member-based activity, whatever that might be.
But that is a real significant shift to do at the end of the New Deal.
It's a significant shift, and, you know...
Are you saying that we should be reading more Rousseau than we should be reading...
I just know that if you're not in those places and those spaces when those discussions are happening, you're not having the discussion.
But it's been replaced
by a more
powerful
platform. If you're arguing the discussion's happening somewhere else.
It's been replaced by a more powerful platform. Dean Jentsch, I think in 2005, meaning it's slightly old, was surmising that around 70% of us had no faith or actively against the idea of a political party. So the model is actually at the moment effectively broken. And what's interesting about that is, in this room, and what we'd agree on, doesn't matter if we are, you know, socialist left or rabid right or in between. So we're beginning to get platforms that are outside of politics. There are new alliances forming, and I do believe that we've got tools to influence, which are not necessarily two people on a living room floor, one of them being Bob Ellis, and a bottle of red wine. That in fact it is a much broader spectrum now, which is both a challenge to coordinate such a diversity of voice, because we don't have the party platform and the Marcier to come back to.
I guess my point is, I agree, it's much, much more diverse, but if you muff that up, what you've just described, that much more diverse, much more complex environment, if you muff that up and your voice isn't part of it, in whatever diverse kind of way you find to make your voice part of it, it ain't part of it. Then that next 4 years passes, and
I would argue that there are several of us that are part of it. I for those of you that don't know, I also work in politics and have worked for independents and minor parties over the years, and have remained in conversation with people from all sides of politics. It's just that the system's broken. The political system is so broken that, you know, it's not just people from the arts sector anymore that aren't members of parties. It's across the board, which, as you said, is lots about unionism as well. So
it's just a, like that old-fashioned notion of the social contract, that sort of New Deal, this how you relate to the state, that came around in the 30s. It's not the 30s anymore. Jesus. Like, globalisation, this thing happened. Remember that? Like, whole kind of globalisation. Reagan, Thatcher, remember them? And that, and Australia took a very active lead in that under sort of both Hawke and William Fraser. Hawke, you know, that happened here under Howard. And the systems of the way people relate to state, even between me, so I'm 33, and the people I work with at Format who are in their early 20s, their relationship to state was very different. They didn't necessarily understand what it was doing. It's like, it takes you hex fees, but what does it actually do? And to get them to see there was an obligation to engage in civic discourse with the state rather than with each other, and there was a very strong civic discourse outside of the state, and to get the people within state to understand how to interact with that discourse was very difficult. It worked. I mean, IDC thinkers, I think ArtsSA did a really good job of it, but again, it came down to these structural points where that dialogue would hit a block, and that block would vibrate a laneway and say, look, problem solved, and just fall apart.
Tim, you say there are mechanisms outside of the traditional governance, you know, machine nowadays. What are there, and how do you think we can leverage them?
Well, I think we're entering really risky territory. So I don't think I'm holding this up as a model, but let's face it, there was a time a few months ago when a Facebook page ran, and as a result, the Liberal Party withdrew its opposition to the small venues bill in the upper house. The risk here, of course, is that my social media is bigger than yours, let's go to war, and, you know, the lobby, the rise of the lobbyist. So I think what we do need to do is look for... last thing I'm going to do is fly a flag for, or hold a candle or whatever it is, for the Integrated Design Commission, but there are these models which look to be the intermediary platforms which understand how government works and understand how you navigate through government. Understand that a minister's office and a department are two different worlds that you should not infer any relationship between. For the record, Alex is nodding. But I believe that there are... I believe it's about mentoring, therefore, younger people, the 23, the early 20s that Yanto's talking about, in that model. I do believe we should be active in politics, not party politics, but policy politics, and be realistic about those things around compromise and how you argue and how you pitch and what's the benefit and what's the value. And sometimes this means reframing your own perspective outside of your sector. I've been pushing very much for this not to be a discussion about arts policy, for example. I believe part of me is being very pragmatic about pushing that into other spheres which should resonate with sort of economic value. So the research that we look to are those places that have done the research on the role of arts and creative practice and creative enterprise and tech-driven startup in city economies. That's where we should be looking if we want to get back to the question at hand. So we need mentors for that. We need the forums, some of which I hope will be developing over the next weeks and months, to provide some of those connections which are outside of politics and yet understand how politics operates. It's being mature and very grown up about it, understanding that cities are at all times very much about things in play and the negotiation of who has influence over those.
I think also, you know, reflecting on the Stan's earlier comments about making art and being dragged in any number of directions away from actually making art, I think, at least in my experience, the fundamentals about making art collaboratively that endure and have endured, you know, for me, good art is a collaborative exercise at its heart. In one way or another, it's either a collaboration between you as an individual artist and your audience, or it's a collaboration between a group of artists and an audience. And I think those tools and those skills, the toolkit of being an artist, bizarrely, again, it's sort of part of this conundrum that I struggle with, that toolkit should be serving you incredibly well, because those skills are at their heart about communication. At their heart, they're about being passionate about something, committed to an idea. It's about exploration, it's about discovery, it's about risk-taking, it's about being willing to throw something out, throw 27 canvases out, paint over them because they're all crap, and then come back and ultimately arrive at the one that that's the right one. All of those skills in that toolkit that is the toolkit of being an artist should be the right toolkit.
Someone's going and somewhere. It's okay, it'll be over in 15 minutes. We're almost out of time. We're going to move to questions in a moment, but I'd kind of just like to maybe wrap this. Scribe, how are you doing? You got everything? Great. Good. Fantastic. I was actually kidding, but all right.
Oh, my God, we're so sorry.
Trish? No.
When we do.
I'd like to just go down 30 seconds or less and kind of finishing on that point about, you know, re-stoking the fire of civic engagement. What do you think is the best way that we can inspire people to become more involved in governance to create the kind of outcomes that they want to see rather than just whinging aimlessly on Twitter? Go.
Can I start? Okay.
Yeah.
We shouldn't have to engage with government, right? It's wonderful that people do, and it does make public servants' jobs much easier, and public servants are humans with feelings. Don't just shout at them over the phone. Like, I've found, you know, if there's any advice that any practitioners out there want to take, it's be nice to the Office of Liquor and Gambling, be nice to whoever you're dealing with in middle management on your local council, because everybody's yelling at them, and most of them justifiably. So if you're the guy who's not yelling at them, they will thank God and be really nice to you.
So be nice.
Yeah, be nice. Just be civil. But
Will, 30 seconds or less.
Okay.
We had this agreement between Stan and I before that he was going to be good cop and I was going to be bad cop. Perfect. So I would say be very nice, but be very clear that if you're not satisfied, then you make it perfectly clear why, how we can expect better service and engagement. And I do suggest that people engage with government, and I think that people should engage with government.
They
shouldn't have to, but I think that they should. My 30 seconds is probably up.
Can I add one more thing?
Oh, God,
one
have mercy. I'm going to cut your mic.
I can't get the feelings hat, but there are artists, there are practitioners out there who are not necessarily capable of dealing with government, but part of, you know, their practice is not having to do these things, you know, because it kind of kills the energy that they have to do these things. So there should be organisations in the private sector that the government is aware of that can redistribute those resources because they're already embedded in the community. Right. That's the only thing I want to...
Yanta.
Okay, so I've already sort of put my issue is that you have a structural fault within the way you run your capital city. So I'm thinking there's a couple of good examples of that and why I think it derails otherwise good strategy and a good relationship between people doing interesting things in and outside the government. One of them is a space called the Reading Room. Are people familiar with the Reading Room? So the Reading Room was the kind of like artist creative run space that was run by the exact same youth demographic you'd like to have in Adelaide. And then the Adelaide City Council ran its own reading room that they couldn't find a building, so they just did it on the street. Having a council that poorly mimics the existing activity of the citizens who use the city creates a tension and a sense of disrespect that hits everybody working in this sector. It's not like you go, okay, we've been disrespected by this organisation, but we're still going to work with ArtsSA and planning. Like once people feel like their voices don't matter, it's very hard to re-engage them with governance writ large. And the other one I'd point out, which I think is important to recognise, is that, you know, we have an entire forum here of, again, mostly the kind of young creative people that Adelaide needs, taking part in an independently run festival. The last time this festival ran, council's funding for it was $20,000. This time it's $3,000. I think that's a really clear indication of how much that particular section of your governance cares about your voices.
Alex.
I guess it's a response to the question and to Stan, Stan's response, and that is, I wonder whether the question is not should you or shouldn't you engage with government, yes or no, but rather should you engage, how are you engaging with and should you be engaging with a broader community beyond the immediate community that you're a part of? Because this will sound really, really, really trite. I know it's going to sound trite, but, you know, government is not actually... government's just a group of people doing a whole range of jobs within a whole policy kind of environment with things called, people called ministers and wah, wah, wah. What they're responding to is a broader population. So the question around the 3am closures or whatever it might be, people don't just sit around in rooms by themselves with their colleagues and dream things up out of thin air. They respond to things that either they're, you know, their minister, their chief executive, their whoever it might be that they're working with or to are interested in. The reason they're interested in those things is because enough people in the broader community are interested in those things. They're not producing policies for things that nobody is interested in outside of this room. And whether that's an interest that's generated by a broadcast media, whether that's an interest that's generated, I'm not valuing one way or another whether that community interest is real or meaningful or has integrity. Personally, I think in many occasions it doesn't. Personally, I think in many occasions it's entirely populist and responding to you know, poor kind of settings and fear and a frightened community. Hmm. So I'm not valuing whether it is. I'm just noting that that's kind of the way it works.
So hire a publicist.
Yeah, that no.
No?
No, don't hire a publicist. That would be a waste of money, hiring a publicist. Yeah. Unless you're hiring...
No, don't mind me.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't be hiring a publicist. It's much more profound and it's much deeper than that.
So how would you go about it?
I think it's what I've said earlier. I think what you do, if you're making good art, you're making good art. If we're talking in this particular domain, in this particular sector, you keep making the really good art, you keep talking about it, you keep finding ways to engage. You're doing this. You do it all the time. It's kind of the point of what you do, make art and have somebody engage with it.
But if you want to make the change that lowers the barrier so other people can make the art...
I got to finish the thing, Yanto. Stop talking. Tim.
Well, what happens is we succeed. Let me tell you how we succeed. Within 6 months, what's happened here is a strange collection of misfits, Yanto, Stan, the rest, have self-organised with the mill, Margarine and Sound Pond and the rest. They hook up with really good people like Richard Brecknock over there. They get a couple of middle-level officers from Demeter. Now, my tip is, except for Alex, go the middle level. Go the middle level where they know, where they're still naive enough to believe that if they go up, change will happen. Through that, what we do is we share data. We all share the data. What are we making? Who are we selling it to? What is our supply chain? The number of that, the quantum of that, that's how you make it matter. You need to put some data behind it so that when it goes to somebody up the chain, decision makers, it's got numbers attached to it. It's going back to data. And until I believe we're probably 2 to 5 years off evidence-based policy, the amount of evidence-based policy that comes out of governments around Australia can be measured on the size of my fingernail, that one. So don't assume that there's a market for it yet. That shouldn't stop you sourcing the data. And really, if we're all in this, it should be in basements like this where we're sharing our data. What did we make last year? What did we lose last year? Where was I educated? But that tells us whether AC Arts matters from an economic perspective in this.
And importantly, who cared about it?
And who cared about it?
Who cared at the end of all of that? Did anybody care about it?
Did
other
anyone
than us?
Care? Good note to end on. We're going to have some... If you have a question, please come up to the microphone in the middle of the room, ask a question. Like 2 sentences max, make sure it has a question mark at the end of it and a rising inflection. And then sit back down. Hey, Robin.
Hi. I just had a quick question, which was, do you think there could possibly be a very small amount of good done by a principal among... you always get up here and then there's this urge to become that horrible person that just talks about... Okay, so... The idea of, like, the Hippocratic Oath of do no harm, because I feel like a lot of the really unpleasant interactions have been where it hasn't actually been about pulling funding, hasn't it been about the artists or the arts organisations or the small groups relying on government to get it right. It has actually been like a fundamental stuff up where there hasn't been any respect shown and where something has been mimicked badly, where it has been undermined. So much as we would love to design the perfect city, much as we would like to have the perfect interaction, what do you think of the principle of doing no harm, of not fucking with things that people have made?
But some of those fuck-ups, like I saw some of them firsthand. Yeah. I saw some of the most brutal ones, and I work with people on both sides. And it's not like there's anyone saying, yep, we're going to fuck this up really badly.
There should be an articulated principle. Contract.
I'd go further and say there has been something of a cultural change in the last five years. And this is a conversation that's come up elsewhere, but it tends to be about the kind of obscure, incredibly boring things you can't do announcements about. So Sydney and Wollongong at the moment, there's lengthy discussions about what kind of human resourcing and internal structures do you need to have so that planning, cultural policy and economic development talk to each other and work cohesively. And in my opinion, that's been one of the faults that's happened here with some of those fuck-ups, that somebody here didn't talk to somebody here because their departments didn't have a formal system of interaction. But, you know, you can change that. It's just, it's not easy.
We often say, and I say, we say a couple of things and keep reminding ourselves of them. One is, how can we get out of the way? We spend a lot of time trying to get out of the way of people and so that people can make art. And the other one I've temporarily forgotten.
Real culture there, yeah. Embedded. It's totally embedded.
Too much sparkling.
Try and get out of the way. No, yeah, it is sort of the do no harm thing, but that's not it, actually. Vicky.
But you did another one. Like, I think the other one you could add to that is that you probably more than a lot of other people actively work to build capacity in the non-government sector.
I've remembered it.
So you built capacity so people could talk without having to rely on you to do it for them.
Yeah, yeah. Now I've forgotten it again. This is really, really bad.
Are there any other questions? Alex might remember. Really fast. Let's go.
Just wondering if is it a matter of changing policy or is it changing people?
Is it a matter of changing policy or changing people?
I think there's great people here. Like, I think there is a legacy of some of the smart stuff that's happened that means that, because it's a regional city and everyone kind of interacts with each other, it's not like, you know, you go to Surrey Hills and it's all the creative industry just talking about creative industry in Surrey Hills and going to a small bar. Here you'll get people who, like, it's the only place you come where you'll find, like, a 22-year-old who can talk to you intelligently about planning policy and cultural policy and how government works and these amazing projects they're doing.
Gross. That's gross.
There's great people. Sorry,
makes me want to leave.
I would list you as one of those people, though. There's great people, I think.
Well, I hate myself, don't I?
There's great people, but I think there's fundamental faults in the policy structure that means that it doesn't make use of their agency.
I remembered what it was. It was why not. We try to ask ourselves a lot, why not? So when someone comes to you with a proposition or an idea about whatever it might be, rather than immediately defaulting to the why that's not possible, in fact asking yourself, why not? Why couldn't we do that? What is wrong with that idea? And as soon as you ask the question, you pretty quickly, most times, realise that there's nothing wrong with the proposition and we can do it.
I remember saying, why not, over the phone to the office of the Liquor and Gambling Commissioner about 5 years ago. And they said, because we've deemed this licence as no longer occasional. You're doing it all the time and you're making too much money.
Were you?
Does he look like he was?
Well, yeah. The place folded shortly after. But now, you know, there does seem to be a sense amongst middle management in both state and local of why not, of, well, or less why not, more like, oh, yeah, we have to do this. Maybe. Now. Oh, there's that whole directive now, don't we?
The okay. Why not directive.
So there is a reluctant kind of why not culture that's built up and, you know, you have to acknowledge it. The cultural change is a rare thing and you do have to acknowledge it when it happens.
I believe we are at the phase of hyperbole and we're yet to allow that to trickle down into reform. I do believe that there is a leadership problem in Adelaide. I believe that people... I'm not pointing at anyone here. Notice I just did that. I do believe that there is a... I do a lot of work interstate and increasingly get to watch people overseas at close quarters. There is a slightly different model of leadership that does allow a banging of the table, that does allow things to be ruthlessly driven through an HR system. Monica Baroni at the City of Sydney is a very, very good operator in understanding how you implement vision. And it's not the hyperbole that she's interested in, it's how you actually link that into KPIs of staff. I don't believe we're there yet. So on the positive side, I believe we've got a change of inflection, and I believe that there is a different dialect at play. I believe now why I'm looking forward to phase two when it hits is that it will be about embedding it into systems, and that's the link between, I believe, policy and people. No number of institutional frameworks will give you a good outcome, but good people with some mediocre institutional frameworks, I think, will give you a good outcome.
Final question. It's time.
Is there a Festival of Unculture webpage or forum, web forum that we could all like on Facebook?
Oh, that's an easy one.
Yes, there's a Facebook page, okay. And it's facebook.com Festival of Unpopular Culture. It's written down on those pink programs on the back of your thing.
Right, tilt it if you need.
No, that's okay. It's a really, really quick one, and it's more about your actual experiences of this. It's more based on my... my experiences, it's a hypothesis I've got around the implementation of certain strategies, you know, vibrancy, creative cities, all of that sort of stuff. You've got these broad overarching policy documents, then it just comes down, it filters through, it gets to the implementation stage down to the ground level, and I reckon there's this kind of intrinsic morality that comes into what gets approval, what doesn't, what gets pushed forward, what doesn't. Even though something that might be considered deviant and inappropriate actually still meets that overarching the requirements of what they're looking for, but for some reason at the ground level implementation it gets held up.
Question is?
Your experiences of anything like that, or am I totally off
center? That is something that we haven't dealt with a lot. It kind of reminds me of the idea of people in government or across, you know, the creative sector having to make decisions about taste, which is a real problem. Mm. And so you have to, you know, blindly look at whether the criteria have been met. Whether they've, you know, whether an application has dealt with certain policy directives that have come from various directions from above. It's something that I struggle with myself. You can't just yell at the government for having bad taste, because it's not the government's job to have any taste at all.
But that's also a policy thing. And like, I mean, arts policy is renowned for being entrenched in ideology. It always has been, like Macaulay memo on in Indian education onwards that created the notion of arts excellence and literary excellence. And people forget that regulation is deeply ideological, particularly because the built environment regulation is so boring. But like, this is the raw politics of how people are allowed to use land in what way, which is why I get kind of cranky when it's like 6,000 people get to make a decision as to how a capital city's run, because you look at those bylaws and they're so dull, but they do things like, oh, you can't feed birds on the road, or you can't do this now. And that somebody's made a decision about you can use this space in this way. And that's, you know, those ideological decisions do completely waste the agency of the people in the city if they're done badly.
I think it's interesting in the art space, of course, we deal with that through something called peer assessment. So, we bring together peers of whatever the particular art form or activity is and say, well, you decide. It's not officers deciding, it's not a minister deciding. And that's not universally agreed either, and people win and lose out of all of that, and it's awful. But it's the best. We often say, and you often say to us, it's the best we have. We haven't come up with a better model yet, and it's the best we have. And I have wondered about that kind of approach to other areas of determining allocation of resources. And it's been interesting in the last 12 months, 2 years, working with DIPD, and just in a tiny ways on things like Unexpected City, some of you will know that, or Unexpected Port, and working with other agencies of government and other parts of government through a peer process. And the first times we talk about that and say, this is how we're going to make those decisions, it's quite a shocking way to make decisions, and yet to us it's just the best way we have and the only way we have. So there's something interesting in there as well.
Jen, did you speak to them really? Oh, that's no, you fine. Just got your microphone looking like you want to do things. That's great. Thank you to all of our panellists for A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to Vibrancy Forum. Stan Money, Jen Grey Holmes, Dr. Yantha Ware, Alex Reed, and Tim Horton. I'm Orma Crosty. Thank you.
This session of the 2013 Adelaide Festival of Ideas was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.